Hello, and welcome to the Classicist Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, here with Victor Davis Hansen, the Martin and Ely Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, I base our discussion today on a piece that you recently had at National Review entitled Why Go West? And the way that you set this piece up is to look at three of the most visible new progressive members of Congress, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, and Rashida Tlaib, all of whom are either the descendants of immigrants or, in Omar's case, an immigrant herself. And given their politics, you find an irony in that fact. Why don't you start us out just by explaining that?
Yeah, well, Omar is an immigrant herself, and Ocasio-Cortez's father was born in the United States, but her mother was an immigrant from Puerto Rico, and then Tlaib's parents came from Palestine. There's nothing wrong with having views critical of the United States, but there is an irony in it that they have both lodged generic complaints, especially Omar, about how disappointed she was when she got here and saw the status of social justice or something in poverty, coming from East Africa, where death and destruction, disease, inequality, oppression, exploitation are just daily occurrences. And then Ocasio-Cortez has been very critical of the United States as well, and, you know, been very laudatory of Puerto Rico. Tlaib just the other day said she was, and one of the craziest things I've ever heard, said she was so proud of her Palestinian heritage because they offered safe refuge to Jews fleeing the Holocaust, and that gave her, you know, calm feelings when she thought of the Holocaust. I don't think one really associates that those feelings, but gosh, we all know the Grand Mufti went to Hitler in 42 and promised to help wipe out all the Jews that set foot in Palestine, in addition to the ones that had been there for 3,000 years. So I guess what I'm saying is there's no recognition that their parents were very lucky to get to the United States and that they grew up in relative affluence and leisure and safety and security, and there's never any acknowledgement of why that was so. And then when you add the second facet is, if you look at their policies, which I guess are socialist, they've all at one time or another described themselves as socialist, and they've described themselves as supporters of the New Green Deal to ban internal combustion engines in 12 years. And I guess we would call it a near Venezuela social justice plan of abolishing ICE and abolishing student debt, abolishing the Electoral College, Medicare for everybody, wealth tax, et cetera, et cetera. They would create the conditions reminiscent of Africa or Latin America. And you wonder, then you would, or the Middle East, which are all in various degrees failed societies. So then you think, why would you flee someplace, your home, or your parents flee your homelands, and then come to its antithesis on your own volition, and then once you get to its volition, advocate policies that would take the United States back to the failed status of your parents or your own homeland. It makes no sense. It's analogous to Californians, you know, that complain about terrible services and high taxes, and they go to Texas or Nevada and they try to recreate California.
Amongst the critics, there is this evergreen bill of indictment against the West that says our history is irreparably marred by racism or sexism or homophobia. Through a historian's lens, Victor, how do you think about those charges?
Well, I think they're pretty absurd because the first question a historian says is compared to what? So chattel slavery is a great sin, but there are societies today that still practice it, or at least an indentured form of it, in Africa, especially in parts of Asia. The United States lost 600,000 of its citizens fighting to abolish that institution, which was largely confined to 11 Confederate states and four or five border states. And it's been over 160 years since that bloodbath. And then the other thing is that country doesn't have to be perfect to be good, because inherent in the Declaration and the Constitution was this Western idea of self-critique, evolution, self-criticism. And that's lacking in most other cultures. So almost immediately from our founding, people were saying we should do this, we should amend that, we should have a Bill of Rights, we should do this. So we're always evolving along these principles, whereas most countries are not doing it. And then finally, more concretely and empirically, why do we have the most immigrants of any country in the world each year? And in fact, we're almost at the point where we have more immigrants trying to get into the United States, or at least arriving in the United States, than all the other immigrants to all the other countries combined. So people are sensing something in the concrete that all of our critics in the abstract are missing. And we know why they're coming, because someone has been in about 50 different countries. I can tell you that I don't want to have my appendix out, ruptured appendix out again in Libya. I don't want to be in a country like Iraq. I don't want to go to Saudi Arabia again. I got very ill in Egypt. I don't feel safe, or I don't feel it's healthy in most parts of Mexico that I've gone to. And there's a certain Inouye or Lotus Land Lala-ism when I go to the Netherlands or Western Europe. So it seems to me, without being too chauvinistic as an American, it compares pretty well with all these different paradigms.
Well, I want to pick up on that, because the fashionable criticism of Western culture, Western civilization these days, is that that phrase is really just a euphemism for a kind of Western chauvinism, that other cultures have their own distinct traditions that have their own value. So one version of this that you'll hear a lot is, well, look at China. This looks to be a pretty successful system, and it comes out of a distinctly different set of principles. How do you parry with arguments like that one?
Well, I agree that China has a very venerable culture. It's got a rich literature. It's got a rich art. There's no doubt about it. But if you're talking about core values, China has no tradition of constitutional government. It has no tradition of anything remotely resembling the Bill of Rights. Chinese literature so often in antiquity is embedded deeply within religion or ideology. You don't have anything like an Aristophanes or Euripides or Cicero railing against the status quo or the government from a secular point of view. And then there's always this reductionist argument of emulation. I mean, when China builds an aircraft carrier, it looks like a Western aircraft carrier. Why don't they build an indigenous design? When China generals put on military uniforms, they look like our uniforms. Why don't they just have their own indigenous types of uniforms that we would emulate? When they build cars, they look like Western cars. When they build trains, they look like Western trains. When they want to drill oil, they use Western science and petroleum engineering. And I just don't see – I mean, there are some things of food, fashion, health, acupuncture – music, art, literature that we get from all these different cultures, and they enrich ours. But these are peripheral notions. They're not the core in matters of politics and economics and food production and metal production and resource production and government. It's Western to the core, the globalized world, and China in particular. I don't think there's 350,000 American students in Chinese university, except maybe to learn Chinese to be better businessmen and more profitable. There are some, but why is China sending this huge population of expatriate students here to live? And why, when they graduate, are so many of them reluctant to go back home? And that's what I don't understand. If, you know, that we're supposed to say that China has a tradition that's no better or no worse than ours or equal to our own. They have a lot of worthy traits. They're very hardworking people. They're very disciplined. They're very innovative. But they're mostly, at least in the 21st century, determined to take Western technology, Western science, Western education, and show the world that it comes despite, not because of, Western freedom and constitutional government. In other words, it says, like the Japanese of the 1930s, we can copy your science, but we can improve and make it more efficient because we don't have things like the EPA or the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals or a neighborhood action group or demonstrations. We just do stuff. We want solar panels or high-speed rail. We just bulldoze down and build it.
You also talk in this piece about the two great liabilities that stem from the successes of Western civilization. I want to take each of those in turn. The first that you identify is that the very fruits of the economic system, the affluence and leisure, can themselves be corrosive of the system that produced them. Explain that.
Well, that's been a theme in Western literature and philosophy going back to critics like Hesiod in the 7th century BC, and then Roman satirists like Petronius, or biographers like Suetonius, or historians like Tacitus, all the way into the German nihilist, Nietzsche, Spengler, Hegel. And their argument is always the same, is that the problem with the West is that not that it's incompetent, but it's too competent. And by that, I mean the marriage of market capitalism and constitutional government and freedom means that the individual citizen is soon given such wealth and abundance and is freed from drudgery and can say and do what he wants that it's very hard to enforce some type of discipline on the appetites, that he overindulges, that he becomes decadent. I'm not necessarily a believer in that critique of the West, but that's surely, it's been popular for 2,500 years. And the way that we've tried to address that in the West is said, well, we're not going to legislate behavior, and we're not going to impinge on freedom, and we're not going to command the economy. But what we are going to do is we're going to have local family values. We're going to have local communities. We're going to have religious prohibitions. We're going to have a culture of shame so that you should not do things that you're otherwise both economically able to do and then legally able to do. But, you know, in times of great prosperity as we are experiencing now, it's very difficult when you look at our urban coastal cultures, especially in the big cities. I mean, we're prolonging adolescence. We've got record low fertility rates. We've got a lot of self-indulgence. And a lot of the characteristics of American popular culture is very reminiscent to what Petronius outlined in the Satyricon about urban life in the Roman globalized Mediterranean Empire.
The other potential liability for the West that you point out in this piece is how delicate the balance between freedom and equality is, and how easily things can go off the rails if we get that balance wrong. Tease that out for us.
Well, there's been a big fight from the very beginning, and it's outlined very scientifically and clearly and brilliantly in Aristotle's Politics, Plato's Laws and Republic, and then empirically when you pick up a forensic speech in Roman or Greek oratory. And it's that should we have an equality of result, which means people have the freedom to do whatever they want? Should we have a quality of opportunity where they have the freedom to do whatever they want, but because people are not equal, either in fate or birth or health or talent or accident, they're not going to have a perfect equality of result? Or should we insist on equality of result? And that is, no matter what you do, the government is going to intervene and redistribute. What Elizabeth Warren said, you didn't build that. Or Barack Obama said, now is not the time to profit. Or at some point you made enough money. And so mostly successful Western societies have said, we're going to give you a guaranteed equality of opportunity. We're not going to discriminate on the basis of race or gender or age or inheritance or family background or aristocratic, whatever. But then when you go out and do what you want, and that creates an individual initiative and a zeal and a drive, and it enriches everybody. The left, of course, says that's trickle down. But then we have other mechanisms. We have the government that can have programs for the poor, or we have a sense of philanthropy that no other country has, like the United States, to even things out. Or we have religious and philosophical doctrine that says, you know what, if you have a 20,000 square foot home, it's not much better than a 2,000 square foot home. Or if you got a Mercedes $100,000 car, it runs no better really than a Honda. So we have ways of rationalizing excessive wealth, that people that have it are not that But the key again is that we create such a vibrant, growing economy that even the people who are not so blessed have a level of affluence that exceeds anybody else in the world, anybody else as far as the middle classes. And then anytime we try to do the opposite, and that was tried in the ancient world, in the medieval world, even in colonial and post-colonial America, and early 19th century America, that is, insist on a Marxist, totalitarian, communist, socialist paradigm, Venezuela, Cuba, where you insist on equality of result, and that is we're going to make everybody even on the back end, even though they're not going in on the front end equal, then that requires a level of coercion, either a Maoist model or a Stalin or a National Socialist model. It usually ends up with a lot of death and destruction. Or if it doesn't end up with death and destruction, it ends up something like contemporary Cuba or North Korea or Venezuela, where people just have lost all initiative because they feel, what's the purpose of taking risk or building a business or improving a farm when the government's going to come in and take all of your profits for itself or to give it to other people who are not so dynamic or industrious.
Final thing that I'll ask you, going back to the three freshman members of Congress that we started this conversation on, should we think of this political trend as cyclical or secular? By which I mean, is there something uniquely menacing about having people in power, I mean indeed a substantial part of the progressive intellectual movement right now, adopting this hostile disposition towards our cultural heritage, or is this just another iteration of something that we've seen before?
I'd like to think it's another iteration in a sense that, you know, Eugene Debs got, I guess it was 2 million votes during the Depression as a third-party socialist candidate. When I was in my teens, I can remember almost every day on the news there was a terrorist bombing somewhere. I went to UC Santa Cruz that had recently opened. I remember 600 kids walking down to protest this or that and opening all the pasture gates to free the cows so these cows would go out and get hit in the traffic. It was kind of a lunacy then. And then it passed. And it usually it reflects a sense of youthful outrage at revolutions of 1848 or tension. And in the 60s, it was the Vietnam War, which led to the women's liberation, to civil rights, etc. And then it sort of, the good things were institutionalized and the bad things were discarded. And that's, I think, where we are now, in the sense that we have a whole cohort of young people that have $1.5 trillion in debt. And they're starting to realize that all those studies courses they took did not result in really any education, except they were kind of arrogant because the courses were zealous. They were deductive. They said, you know, we're going to come into my class and you will be a global warming advocate of stop global warming. Come into my class and you will want to have a racial spoils system, et cetera, et cetera. So all of these young people now are paying off these astronomical loans. And until recently, in a 1% GDP annual growth economy, and they were very susceptible to the idea that so-and-so generation has more than me, or these people bought homes, or they got married early and had children. And then to rationalize their inability to get the type of lifestyles they want, then they blame people. They blame the system, or they blame wealthy people, or they blame white males, or whatever it is. But their protests and their flirtations with socialism, they reflect a profoundly unhappy generation. They remind me of those two commercials. One was Pajama Boy, the kind of spoiled little guy that was an adult, but he was dressed up in children's pajamas, drinking hot chocolate and saying, "Buy Obamacare." And then the other was Life of Julia, where a woman, a cartoon type character, says, from the very moment she was born to the day she dies, there's a government program for her. And you don't really see that type of attraction for those subsidized lifestyles and socialism and periods of rapid economic growth like we did during the Reagan period or even the Bill Clinton period. But after 8 years of a stagnant Obama economy, I think socialism became more palatable, at least the idea of it, because we've never really quite done it. Sometimes when I pay my tax returns, I think it's socialism, but we haven't quite done it yet. And if they did it, I think the romance would quickly dissipate.
All right. You've been listening to the Classicist Podcast with Victor Davis Hanson. Remember, you can read Victor's work at Defining Ideas at hoover.org, as well as at victorhanson.com. And if you enjoy the Classicist, please rate the show on iTunes. For Victor Davis Hanson, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.